This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024.
My name is Alex Jung. I am a comedian based out of Los Angeles. Originally from Dallas, Texas. Been doing stand-up, writing, acting for the past 11 years. Just doing the work out here, and it's been so far so good. They've been treating me all right. That's why I haven't moved to Austin.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over the world. What does it mean to be Vietnamese to you?
Being Vietnamese means that I have the blood of my ancestors in me, showing me that I can do anything, I can persevere through any single situation. Because my parents, you know, as with a lot of Vietnamese first generation kids, our parents risked death and torture and just to get away from a war to come to America. So the world is my oyster, and I have to just be prepared to show up and show out and just represent to the fullest. I think that's so important to me as a Vietnamese person.
Now, growing up, did you think you were funny, or did other people tell you were funny?
I think other people told me I was funny, because I was trying to survive as the youngest kid, and I was like one of the few Asian kids in my neighborhood. So I knew that people liked being around me because I was like different and I was weird. I was kind of like a collector's item. So they hung around with me, and then I used to have people like, "Hey man, we want to hang out with you because you're funny." And I'm like, "What?" I was like, "That's weird." And then I stopped hanging out with them because I'm like super insecure. I learned that word later on, but like, I'm like, why do people want to hang out with me? Now you're creating expectations out of me. So I'm just going to not hang out with you anymore. But looking back, that was a big mistake, because I could have some really cool friends, but hung out with them for a while. And then people around me at school would laugh around me. I loved the attention. And then one day I remember one of the kids was like, "Man, you're always trying to be funny." You know, I was like, "Yeah, I get it, but you keep trying. You keep trying and trying." And I was like, "Oh, well, I'm just trying to bring something to the table. I don't have much else. I'm not good at school. You can't copy off my exam. So I'm trying to give you some laughs, I guess. I like when people laugh, but I didn't know necessarily what it was. I just knew I was just trying to make people laugh."
Yeah. There's some people, comedians, that when you meet them or you hear them just talking regularly, they're not funny. And I feel like when they turn it on, or when they write their bit or they work on their act, you could see the intellectual process come out, and then you could see the funny come out. But I feel like a lot of people, I don't know, maybe I don't know enough of the sample size of comedians in the world, but a lot of them tend to be introverted and not really funny when you meet them. I've met a few, but do you classify yourself as an extrovert, introvert, funny all the time, on all the time, or how do you see yourself?
I think I have that problem of being on all the time. And it's just a need to be liked by everybody.
Yeah.
And I get that has sent me into therapy multiple times. And now I'm like sober because of it, because it's constant validation. And only through the work and therapy that I've been able to realize that, like, no matter, I don't need to impress people all the time. I can just be myself, that I'm good enough for any single situation, that I don't need to entertain. I'm the, I have youngest child syndrome, where I'm just like always, "Hey, everybody look at me." But now I'm just like, all right, pump the brakes, because that could be exhausting and taxing on my mental health. So I need to just do it in doses. You know, I don't have to be on all the time anymore. I've only realized that like literally this year during the pandemic when, you know, I had a child and I realized I can't be on all the time. I need to devote my energy to this child. Then it's honestly made me better at comedy, that I'm not draining the well at all ends. So it's really been helping me out just to, you know, to take a breath, to take a breath.
Comedians are always looking for attention,
yeah,
you know,
and
you see it all through the mainstream. You see it, hear it in the podcasts that they do. And you know, they admit it very openly, the way you just did in the first few minutes of our podcast here. You're like, yeah, I mean, that's like my biggest downfall. Like I'm constantly, yeah. What is that? Where does that come from?
I don't know. I think it's from probably being in a big family, like three brothers, two sisters, being in a big family, but also just not wanting to get picked on. Because I got picked on a lot as a kid, the whole Asian thing. So I ended up emceeing all my like high school shows, pep rallies. And from there, I made like a lot of friends and people like stopped picking on me because they were like, oh, you're funny. All right. We don't have to beat you up anymore, or like try to make you cry. So me offering something to them, bringing something to the table and entertaining them, they didn't hurt me. So being funny was like a big defense mechanism for me.
That's some fucked up shit to hear, man. That, you know,
it's survival of the fittest, man.
Yeah.
That's that Vietnamese in me, man. Survival of the fittest. Let's go.
what like big groups of ethnicities did you grow up around?
Black people, Mexican people, and like trashy white people. You know, not the upper crust, not the, you know, top of the heap white people, but and nothing against them at all. That's just, you know, hey, so what? He has a face tattoo. He's white. That's cool. He's gonna do his thing. He's gonna keep living his life. He says the N word, but I'm gonna accept him. He sings along to all the lyrics. That's what my neighborhood was like in East Dallas, Texas, before it got super gentrified. And we were all friends. We were all friends, man.
Yeah, it was a different time where we can. I mean, maybe we all still do get along. We just, you know,
nah,
we just
get along.
We get along. I think the whole world, you know, the whole, you know, thing of, you know, the polarization of America is something that exists maybe in the internet.
I think it's mostly in the internet and like certain colleges that need attention, or that they need their student enrollment is down. So they need to create these identity crisis and these studies. Like there's people starving and dying out in America, in the greatest power in the world. There's people still dying and being homeless and everything. So instead of fixing that, because that's a bigger problem, it's a class issue. Instead of fixing that, they decide to delve into like identity politics and creating that war online and affecting, you know, kids in school and trying to create this new thing. It's a new thing that people want to distract with. Because if we actually address the real thing, the class warfare, that's what really scares the hell out of all these like old white American institutions. Because if they lose their power, then what are they going to have? Just they only have their boats and their houses and their wives and their girlfriends and their cars. Like, oh, I don't have power. I don't have the real thing that makes me go, you know. So,
but you can argue that what they're fighting for in these colleges is just that very thing, no?
Yeah. No, they're fighting for a lot of that. And I think that's... Yes, that is important. Okay. I'm not saying it's not important. I'm not discounting the struggle of, you know, identities. But why are we creating a whole war based on identity politics instead of, number one, addressing reparations and slavery? Black people that, you know, laid the foundation for America and built America, they still haven't gotten their due. Yet we're focusing on, you know, 56 pronouns. We're not focusing on the big deal, the big issue, because it's so scary to them to actually empower the people that they hurt. Like black people aren't gonna hurt you when they get their due. They're just gonna live their lives. They're normal human beings. So a lot of that has to do with, just avoiding the big issue in America is, addressing slavery, addressing all the people that they hurt, addressing the concentration camps that they created right here in America, giving property back, giving businesses back, empowering those cultures. Instead, they're just like, oh yeah, well, what if this person, I can't believe the bathrooms aren't correct. Oh my God, the bathrooms are not correct. Like, yo, we have bigger issues at stake here. There's kids starving. So why don't we worry about that first? Use those resources. It just goes back to saying that I love to hear if in America, if black people are okay, America's doing great. If we can if like solve that first, then I think the mass media at large or whatever, the big people at power will slowly lose their power. And I think that's the goal, to spread that humongous amount of power amongst people so they can be empowered and continue living their lives, which is not a lot to ask.
This conversation can go in many, many directions right now, but I'm going to follow it along with this Black American conversation because I think this is important. Because recently, I've always heard of this book, the People's History of the U.S. by Howard Zinn, and I've heard people talk about it, and I just always thought it was some dry history book. And I think years past, it would have been a dry history book to me. And I just started to read it. I'm on chapter three right now. But it chronicles the minute Christopher Columbus arrives on the shores of America and the Arawak Indians and the systematic deletion, like the cleansing, the killing of this indigenous tribe of the United States. And you follow Howard Zinn's storytelling of what happens, the annihilation and the systemic annihilation of the Indians, and then how they brought the black slaves from Africa. Then you start to realize the genetic, the coding of American history is rooted in some deep, deep systemic shit. It's not what we, it's it, the shit that we're seeing today is like just a projection of like 400 or 500 years ago of what was started. So I don't think a lot of people, especially Vietnamese people, are aware
No.
that this shit is like this, and it goes all the way to the Vietnam War. It
Yeah.
goes to Afghanistan. It goes to everything that we are witnessing in modern history. This.
I think because we were so scared that we just got here. We just had gotten here. But also, while we're in Vietnam, we saw black soldiers being treated poorly, but we wanted help. So we were like, oh, just like stay quiet, just stay quiet. Don't do anything. Even during the war, like when black soldiers got back to America, they weren't treated any differently. They weren't heroes. They were like, I don't care. They still do to this day, where they get pulled over and they're like, hey, I'm in the army. They're like, yo, shut the fuck up and put your hands on the hood. Like, okay, there was no benefit from it. Like, that's why Muhammad Ali was so important. He was
The
like, yo, ain't no Viet Cong ever called me the N-word.
yeah the Asian Americans in the community today, the really vocal ones, when we talk about these Vietnamese or Asian discussions, they always start with you got to give it up to the black movements, the James Baldwins, the all the intellectuals that the black American intellectuals that went way ahead of our time. And what we are going through right now is nothing compared to the stuff that they had to unfuck
No,
in the history of the Americas.
that doesn't hold a candle to it at all.
No, but
No.
we have to recognize it in our community. And slowly, I think the young Vietnamese Americans are starting to really drill down and you have to give the recognition where it's due, because otherwise we're not really learning anything. We're just thinking that, we just got here 45 years ago, and now we're just
Yeah, if it wasn't for the Civil Rights Act, I believe 19, like early 80s, like I don't know the exact date, but if it wasn't for that, we wouldn't have been able to thrive.
I think it was what much further back than the 80s, but we're looking 60s, and and it started in the 50s, and there's so many voices and thinkers that that really is helping us along with our way today. But the tricky part is also this shit in the media today, where it's hard to kind of have discussions around Stop Asian Hate, when we see like some of the crimes, or a lot of the crimes, are perpetrated by people of color all around the inner cities. And so that's a tough discussion for Vietnamese Americans, especially the older generations, to kind of like wrap their brain around, right? But the reason why all of this crime is happening in the inner city, it's a systemic problem from like hundreds of years ago, and we're just now seeing it bleed into modern society. But I feel like it's not often discussed so openly in our families and in our, group discussions.
And a lot of it is not a race war. They're trying to paint it as a race war. It's more so of a mental illness issue because America doesn't know how to take care of its mentally ill. If we gave people the proper resources instead of fucking fighting another war, maybe that part that w could be addressed. We take care of these people. You got to 5150 some of the people out there. They need to be 5150, have proper mental health institutions. You gotta give them help, whether they like it or not. You look at the track record, that's what happens. When our friends show that they are harming themselves and others, you 5150 them. You're like,
What's
hey,
50? Can we talk about what 5150 means?
yeah, to commit someone to a mental institution against their will. So that's kind of like the term for it. If you did that and you let people just cool off, you give people the right resources, the right programs. I know it can be done because I did it myself. Like I went through the whole 12-step program. I sobered
Wait.
up.
What do you mean you went through the whole, you were 5150'd?
Well, I wasn't 5150, but I know like mental health can be addressed. I know it's not as easy as I'm making it out to be. It's a lot trickier than that. But if people got the proper resources, instead of just throwing tents at them, maybe we can give them proper housing, proper food, clean water, do their laundry, give them a haircut. That's like the first step towards someone reintegrating themselves into society. Instead of just being on the streets, I get it. Our healthcare system is a fucking jacked up. We got the jankiest healthcare system in the world, where ambulances are dropping people off on the side of the street like they're an Uber. Like, what the hell are you doing? This person needs help. You
But
can't
you know
just.
what? This is like predominantly like California, though. It's
Is
not,
it?
I don't think it's like in other parts of the country in the US as much as it is in California. In
Coastal,
California,
yeah, coastal cities for sure. I know
it's
Austin has a huge
everywhere.
problem too, yeah.
Oh, really? Everywhere in California. You just see it, especially in LA. LA has gotten, I grew up here in LA. It's gotten so much worse throughout my life, And then you go to a country
Yeah,
like,
go Mary Garcetti. Yeah,
but
that guy.
you go to Vietnam, and it's like, whoa, there's no home. I've never really saw anybody who's like homeless the way the populations are here.
I think I saw maybe like one or two, but everyone finds a way in Vietnam. That's why I feel like when I visited Vietnam, it reinvigorated my work ethic because I thought I was working hard. And then I went to Vietnam and I was like, damn, they're like sleeping at the place where they work.
Work. They don't fuck around.
Ooh, till like they are selling their goods until like 1:30, 2 a.m. in the morning. They're sleeping right below their counter and they're waking back up at 6 a.m. to reset, and then they are back to business again. So I just didn't realize how brilliant the Vietnamese people are, and it's a very beautiful thing for the country to run like a well-oiled machine with maybe like three stoplights. I think I saw just the whole country itself is gorgeous in that way, because people understand their environment, you know, just moving and shaking. They can feel things. You can feel that moped flying at you at your 7 o'clock, and you know how to like bob it just enough to avoid them without even looking twice. People are on mopeds with kids and puppies and everything, and they're continuing on. That's their day to day. It's amazing.
What,
Like,
when did
seriously,
you go?
I went, I want to say 2016. Yeah. I went there
It's like six.
2016. We flew into Saigon, and we, I know I don't want, I still call it Saigon because I'm stubborn. And my family's are from the south, so I still have a bone to pick with that.
People in Saigon call it Saigon too. It's, yeah,
Yeah.
it's interchangeable.
Some guy tried to correct me when I was in Vietnam. He was like, "Oh, no, you mean Ho Chi Minh City." I'm like, "No, I don't. I mean Saigon. It's so much more beautiful too. It represents us so much better than oh, are you going to HMCA's H MCC or whatever?" I'm like, no. Yeah, shut up. You're ruining my history right now. It's Saigon. It's Saigon all day, every day. And just we flew into Saigon, and then we backpacked all the way up to Hanoi and into Sapa. And then from Sapa, we got on a little tiny plane, flew back down to Saigon. Then we went to Phu Quoc. I didn't even know like we had like a little island off the coast of Vietnam, which had some of the best seafood I've ever tasted. And then, yeah, just seeing the whole co the seeing the whole country and just how what could have been if it wasn't for the war. My father used to say it. I didn't believe him until I went there. It was like, if it wasn't for the war, Vietnam would be, you know, trading with Taiwan and just the likes of that, just that level of technology and innovation. Yeah, it's sad, but just for it took only one generation, half a generation, for Vietnam to be thriving again. That shows like the tenacity of the Vietnamese people. And I think it's a beautiful thing. And that woke
Well,
me up. I got back. I didn't complain about anything for like at least a couple of months. But I'm a comic, so maybe it was a couple of weeks.
there's a lot to unpack in that statement that you made. There's a lot of sadness when I think about the history in the 60s and before that. I mean, if you were to compare like Taiwan, the economies of Taiwan and Vietnam, you go to a place like Vietnam and you could feel like it was on its way to surpass Taiwan. And I think it was beyond Taiwan in the 60s, as I understand it. My in-laws, my wife is Taiwanese, and my father-in-law and I have these discussions where we talk about the economies of Taiwan and Vietnam in the 60s and where it was at. And you could hear it from the stories our parents talk about. The roaring, you know, it felt like the roaring 20s in the US, where the city of Saigon was vibrant and there was like this rock and roll scene. There's like fashion, you know, women with like beautiful, you know, hairdos and shades. And it's just, it was so hip and hopping, right? And, you know, the war comes in and, you know, whatever happened during that time, I mean, it really set us all back. A lot of things have happened since the war, and there's a lot of different players that are involved, both on the Vietnamese, you know, in Vietnam, Vietnamese Americans here in the US, and the government of the United States. There's three different players that were really working towards, you know, embargo lifting, rebuilding, reconstructing. There's a lot of things that are, you know, it's a rich history of things that we, the second generation, are now beginning to unpack, because a lot of things were top secret and, you know, there's so much political stuff happening. But I'm starting to unmask a lot of this stuff, and I want to bring this idea of it takes the entire world to kind of open up to stop wars and to make societies thrive again. And this is Vietnam is
You break it, you buy it, man.
yeah.
Yeah, you do get back to it, but the good thing is that a lot of entertainment is focusing on Vietnam now. I believe like Sony opened up a studio there. If I'm
There's.
correct, Sony opened up a studio. You got more and more production
Yeah.
happening there, and it's not a big ask. It's not a big ask to reinvigorate, like to inject Vietnam with, I guess, a stimulus, if you will. Just to get things going again, just to make sure that the streets are, intact, everything, and the Vietnamese people can do it. They need to work as
It's
much as they
happening.
can.
It's happening. All of this is happening. So let's get back into comedy. We're getting a little we're
Yeah,
getting
it's a little heavy. Sorry,
a lot
I
of no
know.
no 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 no
Sorry, I
I
didn't
really
mean to.
welcome it. I really do
Yeah,
welcome the heaviness, but sometimes we the movie that we
it's
play
just
right
at
here,
the front of our
it
brains.
is, it's at the front of our brain. But what kind of comics inspired you growing up?
The main one, probably Dave Attell, because I used to just watch all kinds of shows, cartoons or whatever, but then while I'm 13, 14, I discovered Insomniac on Comedy Central, and just the lights and just this bumbling guy just going through New York, partying with the wildest people. Just all kinds of characters, and then he would go down and just speak in front of people, and they would all laugh. And I was like, "Ooh, yes, absolutely! I want to be a part of that right there."
How old were you
And
then?
yeah, about 13, 14, maybe 15, just around there. I was in high school, and then that's when I got like the itch to like make people laugh, and I knew that everybody loved this guy, so I was like, "I want to be that guy that everybody loves and just lets hold the floor." And ended up just mostly him. I remember, aside from Attell, the other person that I heard about or heard jokes from was Mitch Hedberg. One of my friends had his album, and he just played it for me. He's like, "Dude, this is a guy named Mitch Hedberg, and he's doing these jokes. I wish somebody would have told me it was stand-up comedy, and that it's a thing that you can do." I would have started a lot sooner than that, but nobody knew it. I was just
At 15, I mean, you can't get earlier than that. I mean,
yeah. Well,
can you?
I think Chappelle
Chappelle,
started
but I
at
mean,
thirteen.
Chappelle's a special situation because his mom and dad, they really understood that, that that's what he wanted to do. And, I think the reason he is so good because his parents really had a hand in, fostering that calling. I think if we all had parents that fostered our calling, there's no telling where and how far we'd all get to.
And they were intellectuals as well,
Intellectual, you're absolutely right.
so they helped him become like just averse of all the subjects in America, race relations, like all the stuff they don't tell you about.
Yeah.
He got
An
an
education
inside
on
look
it.
at that.
Yeah.
Exactly, a free one, a free one,
And
a free quality education.
imagine the shit that they talked about at the dinner table, because the stuff that you talked at the dinner table is what's going to inspire your children to go out and be a voice in the community and society.
Ooh, yeah, just to be a fly on the wall there would change your life. But yeah, I think those are the two main guys. And then I just didn't hear about comedy or watch comedy after that. It was mainly like go to school, focus, study biology, get a degree in that, go on to become a doctor. And as I'm in the middle of all that, I'm still writing. I've always been writing. I wrote thank I'm such a dweeb. I wrote like a bunch of thank you notes to my teachers, but mainly the teachers that I knew I was going to fail their class. So I would write these beautiful little thank you cards. "Hey, thank you. I just have been really struggling with class." I was just lazy, but I wrote them little beautiful thank you cards. And my teacher, actually, in my Vietnamese class, they had a Vietnamese class at my middle school. We were in the portables in the back. We had a Vietnamese teacher, and then I wrote him a thank you note just for everything. And he pulled me aside one day, and he's holding the card. And he's like, "Alex, this is beautifully written. You're a good writer. You're a good writer." I was like, "Oh, I appreciate that. Yeah, can I get that A now?" And then it was just like, "All right, we'll see." Then a couple weeks later, I get my report card, and it is an A. I was able to show my parents. I'm like, "Hey, I got an A in Vietnamese." And she was very proud of that, even though I was like freaking out skipping class, smoking cigarettes and playing pool, like a little freaking thug, drinking beers at that age. Jesus,
Yeah.
I thought it was so cool. But I was able to make it through, and then I kept writing. I kept writing, and then I had a friend who had an aunt in Orange County who was a producer. She got a hold of one of my stories through my friend, and then she was like, "Oh, we should make a movie out of this." And I was like, "Oh, okay, cool. She was like, "Hey, why don't you?" And I was in college by then, so she said, "Yeah, why don't you come here and develop it? I'll make sure you're paid fairly for your script, for your time. I'll give you a place to live." And my girlfriend at the time was like, "Yeah, you're never gonna get to do this ever again, so you should do it." I did it, and I fell in love with it. And my girlfriend at the time was like, "Hey, are you gonna like move back, or is she just gonna try this thing?" And I was like, "I don't think I am." And we ended up breaking up. It was a rough
Wait,
one because
you don't think you am, I don't think I am moving back, or what did you think you were not doing?
I was not moving back to Dallas. I was not
Got it.
moving back. This is my new home, and it hurt like hell. But I knew that this was something that I had to do with my life, because if I just stayed in Dallas, I would just be like a freaking barbecue connoisseur, and build race cars all day, which sounds fucking amazing at
I
this
would do
point.
that.
So I mean, just eating barbecue all day, building like
Ain't
1,000 horsepower
nothing wrong
trucks
with
and
that
whatnot.
life. Yeah.
Not at all. I celebrate it, man. I wish I could be that guy right now. Sometimes I'll get back around to there, but the money will just be different.
Yeah. So
Yeah.
wait, who is this aunt of yours that asked you to come out here?
It was an aunt of my friend's who I knew from back in Dallas, and she's like some Forex. This is before like Forex and like Bitcoin and everything came around. They were on the ground floor of currency exchange. So she made her fortune in currency exchange, but she's also Vietnamese, and she also wanted to get into the entertainment business, and I was like her first try. We did it. The script was written, talent got attached. We through like friends and everything, they got attached, and we were going into principal photography. But then like at that point, she was pulling herself so thin because like the currency exchange world, her own businesses, then now she wants to get into entertainment. Her husband like threatened her with divorce because he was like a stay-at-home dad at that point. I'm like, yo, shut the fuck up, man. Your life is made. All right. Your wife is so successful, but I think his fragile male ego got in the way of him like not being able or him just being a full-time babysitter. So he got into it with her. And then they ended up pulling the plug on the project. But then luckily, like after a couple of years, I got the rights back to the script. But yeah, I just stayed there in Orange County, and she was like, "Well, you can work at my advertising company." She had an advertising company down there as well. So I was writing copy. Loved doing that because I was making like good money. I had free housing. Then my friends that I met throughout the whole process in LA were like, "Hey, Alex, are you gonna do that? I thought you were here to write. You're here to write and do all these other so many things that you have available to you." And I was like, "Ah, damn it, you're right." So cashed my last check, put all my shit in my little MR2 and freaking drove it back up to LA. They gave me a place to stay. And then I just kept going and going and going. And then as in the middle of like, acting, writing, just going on auditions, I like stumble upon like an open mic in the valley. And I was like, "Oh yeah." I look in the window. I'm like, "Oh yeah, I know what this is. This is like, yeah, you're holding the floor, telling jokes. You're emceeing kind of." And I told the guy at the door, I was like, "Oh yeah, this is like where I emcee, right?" And he's like, "No, this is where you do stand-up comedy." First time I ever heard that fucking word.
Wait up, hold up. So you didn't come out to LA to do any stand-up or being a
No.
comedian. You came out to be a filmmaker or a
A
writer?
writer, yeah, a
Like a
writer.
script writer, a
Yeah.
screenwriter.
Yeah. Came out to be a screenwriter, ended up doing comedy. I still write a lot. And
So in Dallas, did you study screenwriting? You just put a script together and you just got passed around and you get invited to.
I just pulled a bunch of scripts online, And I just read every single one of those scripts, and I learned structure. I learned final. I got a like a hacked copy of Final
Final
Draft.
draft.
Of course, if you don't have it, I don't think you're a real writer. Kidding. But I was able to understand the structure and the punctuation and everything, and just refined my script through that process, kind of like just watch and learn, monkey see, monkey do. So that ended, that resulted in that script. And then when I got it back, I ended up turning into a play. I joined like a stage writing program at East West Players. Going to East West Players, I was able to turn into a stage play, and that's the one of the best things I could have done, because I just flushed out the story on a different level. The storytelling is so much more unique, and then that's what I'm sitting with. Then I turn it back into a screenplay, and that's like my baby that I get to like see every time I open up my laptop. I'm like, eh, don't worry, she's gonna be made one day. It's gonna be fine. That's my little magnum opus, if you will. It's gonna get made one day. I love it too much. But eventually, I'll have to either kill it or I'll have to I'll get it made for sure. It's not a tough project to make at all. But in the midst of all that, like I found an open mic, and I decided to just to try it again. And I was like, oh yeah, quick 5 minutes. Light comes from over there. Oh, this is where it's at. This is the thing that can keep me sane. This is the thing that can help me make friends. And yeah, just from there, meeting comics and stuff, I ended up just where I am now. It's a my first love.
How many years ago was the stand-up discovery in the Valley?
8 years.
8 years. So, from the stand-up place in the Valley to the guest, the you discovering the Comedy Store, how many years did that take?
I was 2 years into comedy, just an open micer. Then someone told me I need to go to the Comedy Store on Mondays, and I was like, okay, cool. I went there, signed up for potluck, did my 3 minutes, had an okay set, okay enough for where they invited me back next week. Did that, and just hanging around, finding the Kill Tony show and getting stage time there, because that was fun. And then from there, they told me that some people at the store, as I was hanging out, I had nothing else to do. I was just hanging out all day. They were like, oh no, you need to go come back here on a Tuesday night. Tuesday night is where it's at. And I was like, well, for what? They were like, for Roast Battle. Hottest show in town right now. I was like, okay. So I step into the belly room upstairs, and I see Roast Battle. And you look around, you're like, oh yeah, I could do this. This is good. I understand. Well, there's the DJ, there's the like so-called like the Negro wave. They're like the cheerleaders, and then you got the judges up there. That makes sense to me. I know this is a competition. I understand competition, and I understand how to move through it if I wanted it to be it. And I was like, okay, cool. And I did it, and they loved having me on, because everyone gets to sling their Asian jokes, because like I'm one of like I was the
Oh, so you're
only Asian guy really
like a
battling.
punching bag.
Yeah, but guess what? This punching bag punches back. So you get to punch back. So I'm like, man, let's hear them jokes. Let's hear them jokes. Okay, you got a jab, I got a hook. You got a fucking gut check, I got a haymaker. So it was fun. It was fun. We had so much fun. It made me become 10 times the writer that I was, and I could defend myself on any freaking stage in the country, in the
Okay,
world.
let me ask you. Roast battle, in my mind, I don't know much about it, but is roast battle like there's several of these? Like, because you see it on television, and yeah, roasting is, comedians getting together to put each other down. But
Yeah.
the idea of roast battle, I believe it's Jeff Ross. Is that just pertaining to the Comedy Store, or is it Jeff Ross Roast Battle is a brand that goes everywhere, gets televised, and all of that?
It's a brand that Brian Moses and Jeff Ross really took to an international level. And then all these other shows that you hear about around town, those are our babies. So they inspired all this whole roast movement, all these roast shows around the country. because we did it correctly. We did it the right way. We didn't sell out to, like, the big paychecks, and there were a couple of big paychecks that they were offering them, but no, they wanted to do it right. They wanted to do it on their home at Comedy Central. They didn't want to go the other route, keep it underground until like it, you can't hold it underground anymore, and that's when it became like a show. And I was lucky enough to be on season three, but me being ultra competitive, I was like, no, I belong on season one, because I'm like, I'm moving through these fools. And I'm battling, I'm putting down the work, and then didn't get season one. Then season two came around. I was like, okay, I'm definitely gonna get this. But then during one of my showcase battles, I had a gun jam in my mind. I was just like, I can't get this joke out for some reason. For some reason, it's never happened to me before, where I was like freaking, I was like B Rabbit up out there. I was just like, I can't, and then it just, I was battling another battler who is incredible, and she fucking just took that and whomped. She was so smart. She just let me drown up there, which is what you do. It's a competition, man. There's like so much at stake, and I was just like, I couldn't get it out. And then she just let me. Then she just hit me right back and knocked me out of the park. And then she ended up getting the bookie. So I'm like, okay. I don't know what the hell's going on, but I am so angry and so frustrated. And then I took that out on a lot of people, including, my wife, and the anger and the issues and the drinking. And then I sobered up. And then after I sobered up, I ended up getting season three. I was booked for season three against another Vietnamese roast battler, incredible, Robin Tran. So she was able to share the stage with me. First two Vietnamese people on Comedy Central in the history of Comedy Central. It's a big moment for me. We made it into the Vietnamese newspapers. We got a lot of work, and it like served as a launching pad for a lot of it. And I feel like it's a big reason why I got hired at the Comedy Store, because comedy's fearless, and there's nothing more fearless than roast battle. You get up there and you're about to get hit by everybody.
So you went up against Robin Tran. How did it go?
It went incredible because I know how to write a fucking joke.
But who, I mean, did is there somebody who wins in roast battle? And who won? You or Robin?
I ended up winning because Robin had like kind of a, she had one big bang, but then she tried this one joke that didn't quite hit
Land.
well enough, and it didn't quite land. And then I got her back on another angle, but also credit to Anthony Jeselnik. He gave me his vote because he says, I know how to write a trans joke in the most respectable way possible, where I'm not punching down. So I was like, okay, see, that's
All right.
a,
Yeah, let's get into
yeah,
this.
let's
Let's get into
go,
this.
let's go.
Robin is trans, right?
Yes.
A woman today. But when we opened up this episode, you and I were talking a lot about, racial, and we're talking about labeling 56 pronouns and bathrooms and all of that. So as I'm hearing you battle Robin, I'm thinking in my mind, like, are you and Robin cool?
No, we're
Because
absolutely cool, because we understand. She knows, she understands that whole gender identity battle more than almost all of us. She understands it, but she also understands the play at hand. She understands
wow.
the power grab. She understands it, that
So
that whole community is a power grab for, again, white people, attempting for a power grab, attempting to, shift society in a way that benefits them. All they have to do is dye their hair a bright color and put a bunch of stuff in their biographies, and then they get to tell people what to say, which is awful. Like, just because you're switching up these things, you don't get to tell people what they can and cannot say, because we're from different places and different times and different upbringings. I can say whatever the hell I want to say. Robin can say whatever the hell she wants to say, as long as she's not necessarily hurting people. We can say what we want, as long as it comes, there's like no hate involved in it. There's a lot of hurt involved in it, but there's not a lot of hate involved in it. That's where people get the lines blurred.
Wow, it's so nuanced. Because I can't imagine. Because Robin, I follow her on Instagram, and she's pretty vocal about all of this stuff. But it sounds like what you're saying is you and Robin, you two are aligned in the way that you see this issue.
Yeah, we're first and foremost, we're comedians. You know, we're comedians before any other identity. So we're here to tell jokes and people should laugh. They're jokes. They're jokes. It's fine. There's no HR involved in any of it. But then when it's a slow news day, you get all these bots and these people that are, you know, have been really accomplished much in their life, decide to go after people that are like, you know, working hard, busting their butts to make them make a dollar out of some jokes. They decide that they want to create some news and, you know, bring you into the conversation and make you out to be this villain so they can get clicks on their little fucking blog. And I hope that shit goes away.
Is it good for business for you, or is it bad for business when they do that?
Ah, man, it's both. God, even as much as I hate it, as soon as they put your name in front of so many people, it becomes there's no b bad publicity, of course, unless you're like truly hurting people off stage
Yeah.
or you're a fucking pedophile, then you it's super good for business if you are all about the jokes because
But I mean, look at what happened to
yeah.
fucking Chappelle. He didn't get canceled. They fucking tried to take him down, and I feel like he's even fucking sold out shows, you know?
Because he called it out. He called it out for what it is. Like, our struggles are not the same. You're telling a black man what to say? That's the most, that's, you can't tell black people what to say, period. That's the biggest fucking sin of America. I'm like, how about you go back to your parents' house in fucking, I don't know, in the hills somewhere and just enjoy your trust fund? Because that's what most of them are, a bunch of little trust fund kids that, you know, are gentrifying Brooklyn. You know, kicking these families out of their houses just so they can sit there on their MacBook Pros at a coffee shop and telling people what to do and say. I know you're trying to be the new ruling class. That's all you're trying to be is trying to be the new ruling class. You're not trying to make art. You're not trying to make anything. You're not trying to entertain people. You're trying to control people. And comedians are going to back him 100% in that case, for the
Yeah.
most part.
Yeah,
For
yeah.
the most part, yeah. And people, comedians will turn it. Turn the narratives, of course, to benefit them at certain points. You see certain comics that are doing things, Chappelle, and then certain comics will adjust things to certain points. But luckily for Chappelle, he doesn't need anybody to validate him, which I strive to be that, just to not need any validation. Going back to what we talked about earlier, like that known being just so fucking free, so fucking free. And I admire that, and I admire the work that, you know, the comics amongst me are doing too. Everyone's making money off comedy. We're putting food on our tables through jokes. It's pretty cool. I paid for my wedding through, you know, jokes.
Wow. So you're fully like up and running. You're not like having to work a side hustle.
Oh, no, I'm still hustling, man. I'm still hustling. I work at the store. I flip sneakers. I will, you know, just do commercials as many as I can. That's what saved my ass throughout the entire pandemic is that I booked a commercial and I got health care.
Wow.
I was able to bring my daughter into the world at one of the best hospitals in, you know, the country because I had like amazing health care. But
But
of
hold up,
course, yeah.
you're doing everything in the business. You're not having to go out and drive Uber or work outside. It sounds like you're doing work at the store. When we say the store, we mean the Comedy Store, right? You're doing work at the store, you're getting booked for commercials, you're doing things that are all in alignment with the direction of entertainment.
Yeah.
And that's a big, in LA, that's a big accomplishment for anybody who's from out of town that comes here without any family or backing with support, because it's a tough town to break into.
Yeah, man. It's the toughest goddamn thing I've had to do, no matter how good you are. I heard a quote early on that really like humbled me. It said like there are a million brilliant flakes in LA. I'm like, if I just show up early and stay late, I'll move up the ladder easily. And I
What
did.
a phenomenal thought. is
Yeah.
a million brilliant flakes and just show the fuck up. Because then you'll, by attrition, the law of attrition, people will just drop out and you'll still remain around, you
Yeah.
stick around.
And
Ha
comedy is also brutal in that way because if you quit comedy, no one's going to check on you. If you just stop showing up, people will be like,
A fucking one
all
less fucking one less guy to compete with.
I'll take us 3 minutes. I don't give a fuck. I'll take us three. I'll take us five. I'll take us seven. Hey, it's a cold business, baby.
So I have a funny thing about the Comedy Store. We just talked about this before we got on live here, but when if anybody drives by the Comedy Store, there's you'll see red panels, drapery panels. Many moons ago, I was in the bespoke drapery business, and I'm still in that world in a different way, but we do production in Vietnam doing different product. But I grew up in LA doing all the window coverings. I spent most of my time, and that was kind of my side hustle while I was trying to break into the film game and all this other stuff. But I get a call from one of my designer friends, and he's like, "Yo, we got to go do the Comedy Store." And this is normal, we've done big names, in the past. So I thought it was going to be the inside, but it's actually the red panels that you see when you drive past it. We have to figure out how to mount the brackets and the rods on the outside because there was no existing things to mount
Oh man, what a
those
beautiful
panels.
detail to the whole outside of the Comedy Store. Nobody else has it like that. It's perfect. It's beautiful. I knew an Asian person had to be responsible for that because it's
But
nice and
damn,
perfect.
that thing's been up there for over 10 years for sure.
There's probably mold and asbestos and all kinds of like bodily fluids all drenched in there. It needs a good cleaning. I mean, 50th anniversary is coming up.
That's crazy. Well, we use this fabric called Sunbrella. So it's an outdoor fabric that is like mainly, I think it's made from plastic. So it survives and it's coated in a way where it's durable and it'll last for a long time unless it's like somebody put cigarette burns in it and stuff like that. But it should last a long time, but it still is very bright red every time I drive by it.
Yeah, no, it looks good. It's part of the whole like feel of the store. The store has a certain feel to it. It's very dark. It's dark. It's very welcoming, kind of like, the devil extending his hand out to you and then just so welcoming you in. I love it.
So let me
Not
ask
Satan.
you.
I love the feel. People are
Yeah.
gonna be like, Alex is a Satan worshiper.
Alex sold his devil. I sold his soul to the devil.
That's the only reason that's the only explanation for a Vietnamese man making it in comedy. Oh, he sold his soul. I mean, Illuminati, all that. No,
Exactly.
it's hard work, baby.
So how long does it take to finally, and what does it take to finally, or what are we going to call making it in your eyes? When do you finally say I made it?
Ticket sales. I want to be touring around a year round. I want to be touring. I want to sell out places. Still working on that because I just want to make sure I debut correctly. If I misstep my hour or my half hour debut and it's not right and it doesn't pick up traction, which a lot of times it won't, more so not than it does. A lot of it is just has to do with ticket sales and just people that recognize me and are willing to buy a ticket to go see the silly ass things that I'm gonna say. I think
Okay,
that's
what about the actual process? Like now that we hear that, like in my mind, I'm processing that what you just said, but now I want to hear, is there a structural side to this? Like, okay, 30-minute special, where does that go? How do you construct that? What's the sort of ABCs of like where you are right now to ticket sales at the number that you want it to be?
So the main thing for me on a personal thing is to get past at the Comedy Store. So that's why I'm working as a door guy for minimum wage to get your name on the wall at the Comedy Store. I feel like it's one of the biggest things for any comedian because that means you're good for life. You're good for life at the Comedy Store by being past there, as long as you're still funny and you're not like fucking up and doing like just weird personal shit. That makes it to light, which has happened a lot and caused the downfall of a lot of people. And hey, just don't do stupid shit. But easier said than done. But the structural thing, like the beautiful thing about the Comedy Store is we get the most tourists out of all the comedy clubs. We, everybody knows and loves the Comedy Store brand recognition. People go there, people from all over the world. And when they see you there and you decide to tour, you know, those people will tell other people that they saw you. And then from there, they end up, you know, buying tickets when you come to their town. Because people from all over the world are there, they talk about it, they bring up the names, they look at the lineups. People love comedy and people are comedy fans. So they research you, they want to get invested in you early. And it starts with that process. And then from there, you end up getting looks from certain networks, certain companies, or you start a podcast, you know, that takes off. And then from there, they give you a look. It's all about getting a look, you know.
What does that mean, getting a look?
Well, from my network, agents, managers, people that want to help you, people that want to give you access to the comedy world and to the tour dates and to like to open for people. And that's how a lot of my current leveling up is because of the Comedy Store, because I can open for bigger names. I can open for people that are about to blow. And that's, you know, mainly because they take care of us. They take care of the door guys. Again, that's why I'm there working for minimum wage. I love the place. I've spent many nights there for free. So now the fact that I get to be paid and to get work there and to get stage time there is a humongous blessing, because that's the only place that really takes care of their people. And that's the only place. God, is that the only comedy club I've seen in town that hires Asian people?
Laugh Factory doesn't?
No, I don't see any Asian comics being developed there. That's the only comedy club that develops people. Improv, I've only seen one or two, unless you're like a superstar. You know, your Ken Jeongs and your Ali Wongs and your Jimmy O Yangs, you know, much power to them. But the improv doesn't book any other Asian people outside of that I've seen here and there, you know, little sprinkles, you know, every now and then. But I'm on every single week at the Comedy Store. You see my name every single week. That's true development. Not like a little, they're not giving us crumbs. You know, I'm on the Comedy Store podcast, you know, whenever I can be. Just stuff like that. Stuff like that is so freaking important to developing, you know. Still, I'm gonna consider myself a young comic.
Who drives that development program?
That would be the managers there. And so the talent coordinators, and they're fighting for us.
So I think the owner, the past historical is Mitzi Shore and Pauly Shore, right? Is that the family that is?
Just Mitzi.
So Mitzi was so Pauly was never involved?
No.
And Pauly is a comedian, right? Or no?
Yeah, he's a comic, more so an entertainer than a comic. But, you know, I saw him do stand up a couple weeks ago and it was good. He had a good set based on who he is. Personality, charisma, and just being a silly dude, you know. He's the weasel in real life. That's not a character, that's really who he is. Yeah. He's a super nice guy too.
Yeah, Mitzi's not around anymore, is she?
Correct. Yeah, Mitzi is no longer around, and now you have the new talent coordinator there. I'm not going to say her name just because I don't want her to get bothered by people.
Yeah, and she's the one who is actually like intentionally designing this sort of like, okay, we're going to put Alex on, we're going to give him, you know, time, and we're going to give him stage time. And so there's this intentionality behind helping you out as a up and coming person.
They fought for me recently to film there with a whole project that I'm working on with another guy. Filming's not allowed at the Comedy Store unless you're like a paid regular. You got your name on the wall. It's a big network deal. But the fact that they let me and a lineup, an all Asian lineup, film in the belly room with full on camera setup, the whole cast and crew and everything. They open up the belly room for us just because, you know, I'm one of the door guys there, and they fought for that.
Wow.
Against like upper management, you know. So they were able to get that done, and we were able to go into the Comedy Store with all our equipment and film. And so it's a beautiful thing, and it's an interesting time to be a part of the Comedy Store 50th anniversary, they're actually empowering diverse voices, in and not just in race, in like comedy stylings and identities. You have it's the most diverse club. I mean, in California, it's they don't have like oh, so and so, this is the only night where these people get to perform. Everybody gets to perform everywhere if you're good.
How do you know if you're good?
They'll let you know. You'll get time slots. You'll get the time slots. That's how you know you're
Okay,
good.
but Alex, how do you know personally if you're good?
I know personally I'm good because I can, being a store comic, I can fix any room in the country or in the world. You give me a shit room, you give me five people, I can destroy five people. I can make five people laugh, or I can make 1,000 people laugh. That's how I know I'm good, because there's also a saying that a store comic can fix any room in the country. I'm so glad I started at the Comedy Store, because that's the, you got tourists, you don't know where people are coming from. Like, you don't know what people in freaking Uruguay find funny, or like in New Zealand. You don't know what their comedy tastes are, but the fact that you can go there and make all these people laugh, all these people from around the world laugh at the same joke, that's it's a cakewalk when you get out there. It's a cakewalk when you go out of LA. So me coming up at the Comedy Store, honing my chops at roast battle and being able to defend, like, you got hecklers or whatever here and there. They see an Asian guy up there, they think that they can speak up, or they can like interrupt your set or challenge you. You got another thing coming, because I'm not a sheepish Asian guy that I'm just gonna be like, oh, what? No, I'm like, dude, what you sitting over there, still wearing Cosby's sweater. Like, don't you know? Are you also like, did you sell him the roofies? And then boom, you big dick them on stage. And that pretty much tells them, like, hey, shut the fuck up. You're not a pro. I'm the pro. So when you have that ownership over your talent and your jokes and your whole identity, I think it makes you invincible on any stage. And I can say whatever I want. I can do whatever I want on stage, because none of my jokes are written from a place of hate. So when you have that, it's easy. It's easy when you go around now.
Yeah. Now, the names that you talked about before, Ken Jeong, Ali Wong, all these people that went before you, what do you think they have that propelled them to the top?
Right place, right time. Timing is everything. Because you not everything will happen when you want it to, but it'll happen when you least expect it. Ali Wong, work ethic. Ken Jeong, work ethic.
Like, wow.
Yeah, I mean, he right place, right time. Hangover, baby.
Jimmy O Yang work ethic too, I'm
Yeah,
imagining.
work ethic. As soon as we get frustrated and we want to quit, that's usually when something happens. And that's, he had a tough time too. I talked to him a couple times about that, where he was frustrated, just only being put on all Asian lineups, once a month and that type of bullshit. But the motherfucker knows what he's doing. He's a pro too. And then it took Silicon Valley, a hit show, for people to be like, oh, okay, fine. We'll give you more stage time on the regular lineups, mostly all white lineups at the time. And that's when things happen, and then boom, what, you never stop. Never stop. You can't, yeah, it's easy to get a big one, but to stay in that league is incredibly difficult.
Ronnie Chang is another one that comes to mind.
Oh,
He's
Ronnie Chang, baby.
fucking just a badass.
Godfather. I opened for him because he saw me on Roast Battle on Comedy Central,
Wow.
and reached out to me on Twitter and was like, hey, come open for me. Gave me my own green room, made sure I was paid. I mean, we had a like a rap party afterward, or like, no, I'm sorry, that was for his taping, because I was the funny thing is, I ended up opening for him and being his stand-in for his Netflix taping. So, because we're like kind of like the same
Same
height and the
height.
same hair or whatever, so we ended up working together on that. Then afterwards, I mean, this guy is a monster. And then afterwards, at the rap party, he's over here like walking around like catering to people, like with food, with like Asian cuisine is just putting food on people's plate, like, hey, eat, 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 eat. And oh man,
He's in. He's
he's
a
the godfather.
beast. Yeah, he's a beast. Ryan Chang is a
And not
beast.
just being a beast, but like sharing the wealth.
Yeah, he's very generous out here.
Sharing the wealth, making sure every city he hits, he's like, who's your hottest Asian comic in town right now? All right, they're opening for me.
Damn.
And muscling these motherfuckers to let us, fighting for us, fighting for us. He's one of the few people that fight for the Asian community, the Asian comedians. He's creating a whole fucking wave that he's gonna go down a legend. He's gonna
Yeah,
go
he
down a
will.
legend.
And you can tell he's so smart. He's brilliant and he's just a very intellectual comic.
Incredibly.
Yeah,
And
he
wears the nicest suits. I mean, he's
Yeah,
got the, I mean, I thought I was dapper, DeWong, but man, Ronnie, I mean, yeah, respect to him. One of the few guys where I'm like, I could wear an aoyai on stage. If Ronnie Chang wears like a fucking tuxedo jacket, I could do this. This is fine. I'm gonna do this, and I'm still gonna have a good set. It's a wonderful thing. Yeah, Ronnie's pure fucking work ethic and just moving the right directions, just knowing yes or no, and just being a part of the community. Because a lot of people will come in, they want the shine, they want the time, they want, the checks, but nobody wants to be a part of the community. Not nobody, but like people want to be a part of the community, but they don't do it in the proper way. It's very selfish. We're comedians. I'm a selfish person, almost to a fault, but I know at the end of the day, like I got to take care of people too. I remind myself of my Southern upbringings. I'm like, hospitality, make sure you take care of people. If somebody needs a ride, you give them a ride if they're going in the same direction. Or not, hey, true service happens when it's inconvenient for you. That's when true service happens. And I was able to, help those. And, because I saw how Ronnie moved, and I saw how a couple of the Asian comedians have helped me along the way. And I was able to not be greedy and just like, hey, just pay it out. It's going to come back tenfold. It's going to come back tenfold for sure.
It's so refreshing to have somebody like Ronnie, as a person that has given you the inspiration to do the right thing, and not even like you don't even reference him as, some intellectual giant. You're just like, well, he's just a generous human being. You don't even need to talk about his talent. You just talk about, that generosity. And that's crazy to me. When I see that, it's like, well, this human connection stuff is not really about, your work or how you perform. It's almost like, how they make it, how people make it to the other side is because of their generosity and the love and the empathy and what they've shown their community.
Yeah, if you take care of comedy, it will take care of you, because no one's bigger than comedy. You got people that think they're above all of it and think they deserve all this stuff. And I used to be that guy. I used to be incredibly entitled, incredibly entitled. But now I checked myself and I realized it's not about that. It's about taking care of your community. No matter what industry you're in, you take care of your community and you create those relationships. And when it's time that you need to be taken care of, people are going to line up. People will line up to help. And as long as you make sure, you stay, keep your head above water for the most part. And when there's extra, a little, there's an extra seat at the table, you make sure, that you save that for, the person that did the same to you.
Your mom and dad, are they on board with what you do now?
No.
Really?
My family as a whole have never been to a single show I've done.
Shit.
And I've performed in Dallas and I had all of it. I've invited them and everything. It's just not in their thing. It's not in
Wait,
their process.
nobody, not even the kids, like your siblings?
Nah. I've done so many shows there, like literally 10 minutes from where they are, but we have just a rough history just of all the things we've been through together collectively, or not collectively. Me moving out, they felt like I was abandoning them because they needed like extra help, so a lot of that turned into like resentment. So when I'm like, hey, I'm in your town just doing fun things, I know you're working your ass off 16 hours a day, I know you guys are all trying to keep it together over there, but hey, come out and watch, the youngest one perform. They're just like, no, we got to work.
But what do they do? I mean, what's so important that they can't support their youngest sibling and their son.
I don't know. It's we have a rough history. My sister runs a nail shop. You know, my sister runs a nail shop. Brother is he's a mechanic. Other sister, her and her husband just run a gas station, but it's nothing crazy. Like they're not like super successful or anything because it's like tough times for everybody always. But yeah, and my parents are just my mom stayed at home. You know, when she was still around, she was a stay-at-home mom, so it's not like she could come out, you know, with her health complications. And then my father just doesn't like leaving the house. He's a war vet, so he only comes out like once every now and then because it did a fucking number on his like, you know, mental. So I just know that this is truly for me. This is truly for me. It's not any kind of validation anymore. Like it hurts, but you know, I've also got very thick skin. So I'm just like, all right, I'll just talk about it in therapy. It'll be fine. They gave me a lot of material to work with. So I'm gonna be all right. And you know, that's how it is being a comedian. It's a lot of times it's like a lone wolf thing.
Well, a lot of the shit is trauma induced, right? Like a lot of the material is like trauma induced, and sometimes you might have to ask yourself. And I, this is how I go through shit too. It's because of all the heartache and because of all the crazy shit that we encounter and we experience. It propels us to do the work that we do in the creative business.
Yeah, and I think greatness comes out of that. It's the whole like bottlenecking effect of like creativity. And I think like the less struggle we have, the shittier art we make.
Yeah, it's so true. It
Yeah,
is.
that's why when people get big, it's so hard for them to stay relevant. Because you know, you're gonna complain about your yacht. What are you gonna complain about on stage? What are you gonna talk about the nuances between caviar? Like, oh, well, what's the deal with black caviar? Like, no, people, you will immediately alienate people. I'm also glad I have my wife and my kids to keep me grounded because that keeps me super humble no matter how far this goes. I'm like, hey, I'm always gonna stop what I'm doing to play with my kids. I'm always gonna stop what I'm doing to, you know, take my wife out to a dinner whenever that happens. But it's tricky because it's only gonna get busier, you know, as things progress. So luckily we have technology and we can stay in touch, you know.
But it's an amazing thing that you can support your family with the entertainment work that you do.
Yeah.
That's that, not everybody can say that.
Well, my wife's also very successful, so that helps. She's successful in her own right. Or else, that's also, I'm just very fortunate that a woman wants my time a day. That's also very successful, beautiful, intelligent, caring. And I'm just very fortunate that to have that. And she's also like one of the foundations of our family.
Yeah, it sounds like it. She understands the journey.
Yeah, funny enough, Vietnamese women, man, they're tough. They're tough as nails. And boy, whoo, but
It work.
make it work as long as you step the fuck up.
Yeah.
And yeah.
And arguably that's another pressure that makes you advance, right? It's the
Yeah.
that pressure that it's like, well, are you showing up or are you just fucking around? Because you gotta pick a
Yeah.
path here because we need to eat and our family needs to be comfortable.
Yeah. Ali Wong has a joke in her new special about how her nephew is, or how people want somebody that's chill. Like, chill don't pay the bills. And
Chill,
that's
don't pay the
so
bills.
brilliant. It's so brilliant. Like, yeah, like everybody, oh, chill. You know, yeah. I don't want to date a chill person either. No. My wife's a maniac in her own right, and she gets shit done.
Yeah.
And I love it. If it was chill, we'd be living even further below the line of poverty. God damn, are you kidding me? No, that's a certain quality of life we're trying to aim for here, and
Yeah.
chill doesn't fit anywhere in there. Maybe on vacation. Maybe we'll chill on vacation. But yeah.
So what's up? What's up next, the next few years? What are we looking at?
Comedy Store. Working there on getting past, and then from there moving up the ladder, maybe into like to be able to create enough revenue from comedy to invest. I am a part of the Comedy Store podcast. I wanted to do a podcast too. I admire people that do podcasts because it's so much work. But then eventually I'll end up starting a podcast when I feel like the timing's right, when I start, you know, finding an angle, you know, because it's so tricky. There's like a billion podcasts out there, but also there's like quite a few comedians out there. People have reminded me, like, even though like there's so many people doing so many things, like if you're able to excel in that, you know, arena, then hey, you're doing something right, you know. Shout outs to all those people for sure. But mostly comedy, man, and just being a part of a couple of projects that I'm waiting to see where they go. If they decide to go, then hopefully that generates more fans, because that's been my approach since I act as well. If I can, you know, be a part of that, go the Jimmy O Yang route, you know, get on a really cool TV show that's widely loved, then, you know, turning that into ticket sales. And then I'll continue doing like little clips of my stand-up after, you know, my half hour debut, because you do a half hour as an introduction to the world. Hey, here's a quick half hour. Come check me out. Then you develop your hour. And then from there, then that turns into like tour dates. So I just got to stay healthy for that. Got to stay mentally healthy and make sure I don't burn everything down. That's a tough thing. That's what therapy is for. Make sure I don't burn everything down in the midst of all this, because it's only going to get busier. But who knows, man? And that's a loaded question. Who knows what's going to be next? Because I'm just going to keep working on my stand-up act and keep auditioning and keep showing up. And we'll see where it goes. I just know that I'm. You could always find me at the store. That's my home base, man. I love that place.
You know, that's a breeding grounds for like the top comics in the United States, because a lot of big ass names come from that place. And I hope, in the same vein, the choice for me to ask certain guests to come on to my podcast is sort of like that, kind of like that idea is like, hopefully, you know, the entire world hasn't heard about you, but you know, we could dig back into my library and go, yeah, Alex Zung was on, you know, years ago, and, you know, has continued to come on a few more times, and, you know, we can catch that wave to witness you blowing the fuck up in the US, you know, and that is my hope. And I know that I do want to get to the other comics, but you are the first Vietnamese American comic to come on to the podcast. And
wow. Huge honor. I appreciate that. That means a lot.
Well, you know, I mean, your work ethic shows, and, you know, it's just a matter of time if you don't stop, right? If you don't stop, we're gonna see a lot more of you and hear more of you. And I'm here to support you getting more fans, and, you know, and I'm, you know, in the same boat. We're just, you know, we have to show up and we have to grind this out until, you know, our amplified voice collectively gets all over the map. And, you know, and that's the most important thing.
Yeah, man, Vietnamese people, we got what it takes. We do have what it takes. The tenacity of the Vietnamese people is just unmatched. And as soon as we find our groove in the entertainment industry, they're starting to let us in here and there. We're being sprinkled around, you know, and you got your Rosie Trans, like Maggie Q was the first Vietnamese American actress. She laid the groundwork, and man, still looks incredible. I'm like, wow.
I saw Maggie Q at an event recently. She was just still amazing.
Yeah, incredible actress, incredible martial artist. And the more and more we just keep supporting each other, I think that's a big rift that we have. This, you know, trauma.
It is.
Trauma
it is.
Just so keeping us apart from each other. But if we actually continue to support each other, I think it's going to result in some bigger things. And honestly, I haven't done a lot of Vietnamese podcasts. I've been asked to do, you know, certain interviews and stuff. And I don't do it necessarily because some people don't truly appreciate comedy. You know, like, we don't have a true interest. It's just a slow news day. And I'm like, nah, I'm good. I'm only going to take time away from my daughter, my family, and my writing and all that stuff for people that care. So I appreciate you actually caring and loving, and you're a part of the Comedy Store. Shit, that's incredible. So
I'm
hats
literally
off
on the
to
outside of the Comedy Store.
you. Hilarious. Yeah,
But
so hats off to you. Yeah.
I love comedy. I wish I followed it more. I'm, more of the podcast world. I follow and listen to a lot of podcasts, but comedy is certainly, especially black comedians. For me and my brother, we are just diehard fans of, these old school comics and, Richard
Yeah.
Pryor and all those early
I got
names.
their vinyls on my wall out there. Your
Yeah.
Pryors, your Eddie
Eddie
Murphys.
Murphy, yeah.
Of course, they changed the landscape of comedy. And I mean, and the black comics around the Comedy Store, hard to follow.
They
Hard to
are.
follow, man. You got killers like black comedians changed the whole landscape of comedy. Like now, even though I think it's just a part of culture, like black people are like humongously responsible for society and how it moves. What's cool, right? What's cool?
No doubt.
So you're starting to see I guess for a lack of a better word, like AAVE, African American Verbal, whatever they late coined it, but I see it so much now that I'm aware of it. But I've always been aware of it. A lot of the yas and all the all the verbiage that white women love to like scream out, it's all black culture. It's
It's
all black culture.
ingrained in the American lexicon,
Yeah, but yet they can't get a loan. It's tough.
It's fucked
So
up. Yeah.
as soon as we shift that, but I didn't mean to drive it back to a dark to like a heavy, heavy place. But the black comedians at the store, man, you got a couple that I know are about to become a household fucking name, and they got nothing but love for the Comedy Store, and they take care of everybody there too.
Well,
It's
look, we'll
beautiful.
take care of each other, you and me,
Yeah.
and I hope to bring more comedians on with your help, hopefully.
Yeah.
We'll get some
I'll
names
send them
on
your
and
way, baby.
yeah, get them up.
We got like a couple of them, just enough to sit at one table for a dinner, but that's how many of them are here right now,
We
but it's
should do
growing.
that. Yeah, we should
Yeah.
definitely do that. Alex, thank you so much for your time
Yeah.
today, and I will hope to see you soon. We don't live too far
Yeah.
from each other.
Yeah. Hey, I'm always at the Comedy Store, so hit me up when you want to come by. Bring a date. Make it a date night. It'll be fun. I'll bring the homies, bring the family. So you guys are a part of the Comedy Store. There's no reason why you shouldn't go there, enjoy some jokes, man.
Will do, man. I appreciate it
Yeah.
once again.
Absolutely. Hey,
All
my
right.
pleasure, man. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Alex.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. The Vietnamese is produced by Brittany Tran. Special thanks to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast. You can also find us on YouTube, where you can subscribe, like, and comment. Please rate and give us a review wherever you find our podcasts. Thanks again for listening.